I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine. Today, my guest is psychologist, activist, and speaker Doreen Dodgen McGee, who has recently published Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in Today's Digital World. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, the use of phones and other digital devices in our world is now ubiquitous. We can't get away from it. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that our digital landscape is shaping us?
Our technology allows us to be connected to more people and more kinds of people than we've ever been able to be connected to, which I think is really profound. As an activist, I would say it helps us to organize and to mobilize, and that is also very important and a beautiful gift that it has given us. On the negative side of things, and I probably will lean a little bit that way today, just because it's very easy to find access to the bright, shiny, wonderful things about tech, and not as easy to find some of the ways it's profoundly impacting us negatively. But I find four areas of impact in the research, both in the clinical and peer-reviewed research and in my own anecdotal research, having now done this for 15 years. And that is that, or those four areas are, first of all, we just are living differently in our skin. And there's kind of this sense of disembodiment that we have a bulk of our experiences in digital landscapes rather than in our actual physical ones. And that there's a profound impact that price we pay kind of as a result of that. We have, you know, body dysmorphia. We're constantly comparing our bodies to the bodies of very altered, you know, images that we see online. We also see that we just aren't as used to the mess and risk of embodied experiences in the same way that we used to be. We also see a profound impact in terms of the development of the brain or the wiring of the brain. The brain wires together where it fires together. And that means that we need to stimulate the brain with lots of different kinds of experiences in order to create the kind of complex neural pathways that make for healthy functioning. And when we do too much on our screens, that is, even if it's a different kind of thing on our screens each time, our interaction is still with the exact same kind of platform, which means the wiring in the brain gets very robust in a certain, you know, in some regions and prunes off other regions. And those regions are the ones related to focus, to kind of attuned communication, to the ability to stop and start behaviors. These are really important regions. So we're seeing changes there. So when we say that people who use a lot of tech are distracted and look like they, you know, are suffering with ADHD, it isn't that they're just trying to be difficult or not focus. It's literally that their brains are no longer wired in the same robust manner for focus. And then the last two areas are relationships. The way our relationships are formed are now based on kind of intimacy at the push of a button rather than on built, sustained kind of trust building foundations that tend to be a little more hardy and robust for the difficult times in life. And then finally, we really are seeing a profound change in the way that people develop a sense of self and the way that they're kind of connected to their own kind of personal agency and their own sense of values. And now it's a lot easier to rely on external forces of reinforcement with our devices than it is to kind of do the hard work of creating what I call and other therapists call an internal locus of control, where we know we have the grit and resilience and the ability to kind of come back into ourselves and find our power.
Those are really profound.
They are.
These are deep sense of self, dealing with relationships, the messiness of life. Can you talk a little bit about that first one? I'm curious. It makes it harder for us to deal with the messiness of embodied communication.
Exactly. So both embodied communication and embodied experiences. So for instance, we without even thinking about it, we develop an ability to be out and about in the world, and we really develop an ability to like deal with interpersonal conflict or discomfort, even when we're just at the grocery store buying groceries, just by having to have interactions with the people around us and by having to maybe, you know, look into the eyes of the person who we're offering our card or our money to. And as we offload more and more of our experiences to digital spaces, having more and more things just delivered to our doors, we're robbing ourselves of the opportunity opportunity for those kind of bumping up against people and learning the small ways of communicating that eventually can also help with the larger ways. The other thing about embodiment is that we used to have to, life just forced us to deal with boredom now and then. And now we really, because of the power of the technology that we hold in our pockets, we no longer have to be bored. We can avoid it at all costs. And boredom forces us to use this thing that is our body in creative ways. It forces us to kind of either get up and get moving to stimulate ourselves, or if we don't, we, you know, have some consequences that then may motivate us. If we aren't practicing these things deliberately, we then end up with this very contained life where we don't also know how or feel like we have the kind of capacity to take the small risks of getting out into the world again in our bodies. So we doubly hurt ourselves. We don't have the experiences, which then robs us of the potential for creating the experiences.
Do you think that some of this also affects things like social anxiety, which is at very high levels, particularly among young people, I believe?
It is. And we have our first research now that shows not only a correlation between specifically high levels of social media use, which in the research, high use was 30 minutes a day, which is actually quite low. But we now not only have this research that shows a correlation between that use and anxiety and an agitated fear of missing out, but also a causal effect, that amount of use of social media can cause anxiety and can cause this kind of agitation. So I have to believe that not only does our social media use tie in with a sense of social anxiety, but also things like video gaming or viewing a lot of overstimulating visual, auditory kind of digital content, specifically violence in particular, leads us to be also very highly dysregulated in our bodies. We have a lot of hormones, we have a lot of neurotransmitters that are being released that also kind of feel like, mimic, or create anxiety. And so we have kind of this massive soup of a world now that actually does really deeply and profoundly affect our mental health. And yet we also have a mental health system and a health system that doesn't actually code or recognize internet use, gaming, social media use as addictive. And I think we are in some ways complicit to some of the problems until we name that. The World Health Organization has named that as an addictive diagnostic category so that we can have some protocols for how we can help people.
And it strikes me also that in addition to this, you know, what you're describing as a lot of stimulation, a lot of hormones, we're also stationary for most of the time.
Absolutely. We don't have the same way of kind of coming back to regulated states. You know, we used to listen to our bodily message indicators, and if we were overstimulated, we would maybe find a way to calm down. But now we get overstimulated, and the level, and especially if we're in a digital space, the level of dopamine that's released is so high, and that's the neurotransmitter that makes us want to see what's going to happen next and see if we can attain kind of an altered state in that space. And so we actually stay in the space that's overstimulating us rather than listening to these indicators that tell us to do something different.
Do you see widespread digital addiction, and do you think that's a thing?
I do think it's a thing. I think, like I said, we don't recognize it as a diagnostic category in the United States, but I certainly think that the evidence is there and the research is there that shows that the same kinds of physiological and behavioral responses to technology that exist with addictions around food, around gambling, exist. I also think that it's important to think about whether we think that there is addiction or not, that we do need to take a good, long, hard look at our own dependency. And oftentimes people will say, it's a problem for someone over there. And rarely will they see that the ways in their own life that they've become dependent, even if it isn't to a level of addiction, even that dependence may be impacting them in some negative ways, may have some beautiful positive things as well. But it would be important for us to kind of own the whole kind of gamut of dependent properties that certainly are elicited.
At some point in your book, students ask a question, but I think this is a question that a lot of people are asking, which is, on one hand, we know that there are some problems with overuse of media, and we would like to have some limits or boundaries, but in education, in work, we are often required to be hooked into all of these technologies as part of our job or as what we need to do our jobs. So how in the world can we set limits when we are required to be responsive to a variety of media?
Yes, you are hitting a nail on the head. The first thing I want to say in response to this is that I am just so troubled by the fact that my generation has handed, you know, younger generations this beautiful technology, this beautiful, shiny, sparkly tool, and then we've done nothing but talk smack about them for using it, and we've modeled horribly how to use it well. And so I think...
Say more about that. How have we been poor role models.
Yeah, well, we are telling our kids or the children in our lives, you know, that they're entitled and that they are distracted and they have to have their devices. But all the while, we are driving with our devices, directing us everywhere, you know, candy crushing at the red lights and texting and emailing and not really owning our own kind of use as well. And so I think that has created a reality where it is hard to even want to seek out help around how do we moderate this when we are so required to be dialed in, because there's so much shame involved in kind of the fact in owning the fact that we are pretty dependent often, that shame dynamic. So first, I think we have to deal with, we just are where we are, and there doesn't need to be shame around it. And that we also have to face the reality that this is something we have to use. So for instance, just trying to do, I'm not a big fan of what a lot of people call digital detoxes, because those create kind of like what a very restrictive diet creates, which is this kind of, you know, obsession with the thing you can't have. and instead, I like to think about, okay, if we do have to be online for school and for work and responsive at, you know, every minute to our texts, because we really have either been required to be by our employer or our educator, or we have trained our world that we will be by our own need to be that tapped in, that what we can do is create small changes in our lives. First of all, we can make sure that we're tending to our embodied lives. So we have fiery opportunities where we're doing things that are a little bit edgy and risky, maybe, that bring us to life and that
like
bring us
what?
Silly things like I carry sidewalk chalk with me everywhere I go, and I make little welcome mats outside of people's car doors, or people watching, or taking a dance class, or learning to knit, or joining a choir, or, you know, just whatever thing that's going to like actually be a muse that makes it such that a little bit of time every week you're spending away from your device and
you're consciously doing that.
Exactly. And you're enjoying and building up your ability to kind of be just in your skin. And then the other thing I think that the research is really clear about, and this is research in the world of, it grew out of the world of yoga, but showing that 10 minutes a day of mindfulness meditation, when that is sustained for 4 to 6 months, has the power of doubling the gray matter in the regions of the brain that are responsible for focus and attuned communication. And so if we can even just add in a couple of times a day where we are either meditating, or that could look like praying, or the big thing I am now working on in my work now is boredom. If we're just willing to be bored, I feel like if I could invite everyone to 2 10-minute boredom parties every day, you know, we would grow our capacity to kind of be curious again, and to tap into our imagination more than tapping into our apps or our devices. And those small changes, I think, can begin to have a profound effect, because they kind of create also a longing for coming back to them. And I think that's, you know, we have lots of things that reinforce us coming back to our phones. You're absolutely right. They are created now to be very, very dependent forming or addictive. There is a whole movement in the marketing world called the hidden curriculum. And that hidden curriculum is just to keep us in app as much as humanly possible. And that's why we see now all of our apps offering us the opportunity to send video and photos and exchange money and, you know, to keep us there, because that's data for them. We are not these platforms' clients. We are the product that they sell to their clients who are marketers.
I was going to ask you about that. Who is this serving to have so much of the population on this digital technology all the time? Who benefits?
I think it serves the capitalist, you know, agenda. It's money and power. You know, the more that they know who we are and how we spend our time, you know, there was a huge expose in the New York Times last month about the GPS location that is, you know, saved by us having our phones on when we drive all the time, and just how a person's map tells so much about them to marketers. And that can be then very effective in terms of selling product and selling even services. The other thing is power. Right now, I think, you know, people, the more data they have about us, the more power they can exert over lots of things: our ideas, our ideology, the way we will be tempted to spend our time or not. And I think there are three levels of responsibility with this. There is a personal responsibility where we do have that kind of small feeling that, oof, maybe we share a little bit too freely and we should read the things we're agreeing to when we download an app. Many apps, when you download them, you give them passive consent to follow your GPS location and to access your microphone, and you don't even know you're doing this. I don't know I'm doing this. So, you know, so there's that personal level of accountability. Then I think there's kind of the accountability of kind of who I think of as tribal or communal elders, you know, the people in the community who should have this knowledge and help people be inspired: physicians, faith leaders, teachers, you know, and help.
Who model.
Exactly, who model and who give people opportunities for trying to learn or be entertained or experience things in different ways. And then I do think that there is a level of legislative responsibility. Then that's where I'm kind of beginning to push my work in terms of just accountability around things like privacy, around the way that our technology is manufactured and the way that it is monitored, and also the level of transparency that is given to us about how much about us is tracked.
We're in a world where we are being shaped and we're dependent on digital technology, but we don't know how to control it or how to establish, for example, social norms. Mm-hmm. And who is in charge of doing that? It's kind of like all of this, you know, has kind of, it's almost like the machine is running us. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of scrambling to say, well, how do we get control of this thing?
Right.
And how does any one person, for example, help to establish the social norm as to what we should do? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think it's going to be a growing question, and a lot of tech companies and think tanks are, you know, really employing the work of and the thoughts of ethicists, and I think that's going to be really important. I have to bring it down in my work to this very small space where I say, I am the only one that I can, you know, really control for sure. And I just want to invite as many people into the awareness as possible. And then also invite people into all kinds of awkward moments with me. Because I think part of what you're saying is, you know, we don't know the social norms anymore, and we don't know the how to be with each other. And so I just literally try to be as open of a presence as I can be, inviting awkwardness. Because if we can do that, then we can look up again rather than being in social spaces and being, you know, looking down. So I think, it again, there are levels at which we have to approach this. And it can feel really overwhelming. So one place to start is just with yourself and putting your phone down and looking up and around at people and starting conversations, even if they go nowhere. But making sure that there are some of us out and about in the world who are still championing embodied encounter without shaming technology. I think that's the biggest thing. We cannot shame it. It is a necessary part of our lives now. And to shame kind of, it's a form of judgment that puts you in a hierarchical position of one up. And I think that's an unfortunate thing. But as much as we can look up and around, I think is the answer that I can give.
You talk about the value of boredom, the value of discomfort, the value of having awkward social interactions, which I can imagine to perhaps a young person, they say, what value is there in that?
So true.
So if you were talking to somebody and saying, look, here's some reasons why you might want to put down your phone, they would say, well, what kind of reasons are those?
Yeah. I would probably in that situation talk about the great gift that we can have in finding deeper access to who we are and who the people around us are. Usually, that's not going to be something that I can do by just talking. But if I can invite, you know, so what I'll do oftentimes on university campuses is I will say, hey, I'm going to be at the coffee shop at 1:00 and I would love to talk to as many gamers as possible. So if all of you gamers can come on down, you know, that'd be great. And what ends up happening is we realize we have a 2-hour conversation where no one has looked at a screen and we've all shared and gotten, you know, some new information. And then we've kind of been able to reflect on that moment and say, hey, we just did this thing. How did this feel to you? And usually people say, it felt amazing. It felt so cool. And I think that's what I hope to do is to be able to more than speak at why these things are important would be to catch the moment and have create embodied kind of these are those awkward-y, you know, experiences. There's a whole school of psychological intervention right now, which I'm so grateful it exists, but I'm so sad that it has to exist, which is just taking people into social settings and doing things like having them, you know, quote unquote, accidentally spill an entire little coin purse of coins and have to pick them up in the presence of a coffee shop, you know, where people are there working and then use that to pay for their coffee because we now can do that online, you know, order our coffee ahead, pick it up at a separate counter, never have to interact with anybody. And it just, I wish that we could just offer those opportunities naturally at the same time as using our tech, but not completely losing all of those small teaching moments.
It's interesting that we have more isolation and more depression, and there is a correlation between use of technology and really what we're seeing as epidemic levels of depression and isolation. Mm-hmm. Do you think that digital technology is... Sorry, let me say that again. Do you think that digital technology is replacing social relationships for most people?
The way that I think about this issue is that is kind of like this. I use a story because I think that the relationships that we do create in digital spaces are very, very real in most cases. But I, after, you know, looking at the research and talking with many thousands of people now over the last 15 years, the story that really resonates most with me is that if I were at the beginning of a running race and my stomach was empty and I hadn't had time to eat that morning and I was just, you know, thinking, what can I do? What can I do? It feels so empty. I could grab my water bottle and just drink the whole thing and it would feel, my stomach would feel full. It would stop growling. I would feel like, okay, I'm ready. I got this. But by, you know, half a mile, I would realize I have no calories for this run. I have no nutrients. I just faked my stomach into feeling full. And that's what I hear from people who are really finding that they feel lonely, and yet they have huge connections in online spaces. It feels a little bit like water, and it feels good in the moment, but when the really gritty or difficult or challenging things happen in a person's embodied life, they don't always have the people in the spaces that they need them to be, or they don't have the depth where they feel like they can be as vulnerable as they maybe need to be. And so that's the analogy I use. And I think it's interesting, you know, most of our large social media platforms are talking about some of the research that suggests that they are correlated with depression and isolation. And I had a phone call with someone from one of them not long ago who was asking me, what could we do to help with this problem that, you know, heightened use of social media is correlated with isolation and loneliness? And my response is, all the things you could do are things you're never going to do, like time people out after 30 minutes and you can't come back in for another. But again, it's all tied to money and power and influence. And I just think we have created a reality that now it's going to be very hard for us to come back from, possible, but difficult.
Can I ask you how you came about writing this book?
Yeah, two things happened, kind of like a convergence. My husband, first of all, was working in high tech and was talking about the development of the smartphone at that point, right at the same time as my own children were in middle school and flip phones were entering the picture. And so as a psychologist who very much believes in interpersonal neurobiology, so saying that it is within the context of meaningful relationship that we learn best and that the brain wires best, I was watching these little flip phones totally interrupt kind of all of the relational moments of these middle school age children. At the same time, I became an auntie and wanted to gift my nephew with some of the same creative, really wildly creative toys that my brother and I had loved and that my children had loved. And I found that even in just that 13 years since my own children were brought into the world, most preschool toys had become chipped. So instead of sitting on the floor, you know, parents sitting on the floor and making cow sounds with their little toddler, now you put the cow in a little spot on the machine and it makes the cow sound for you. Or the Hot Wheels toys, instead of running them around on the ground, now you put them on top of an iPad and the track moves under them. And so I started looking at this and thinking, how can this be a good idea? and knowing that we in America are not good at moderation, whatever's shiny and exciting, we want more, 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 more. So I began, I asked my family if they might be willing to take somewhat of a moderate approach to tech and if they'd have kind of joined me in having a lot of wild, fiery things around our house. So we still, even though my kids are grown and gone, have bins of Legos and bowls of kinetic sand and Etch-a-Sketches around on all the coffee tables, balance boards and places for people to stand on. And then I started writing to some of these toy companies and never could get a response. So I decided I'm going to just dedicate some time to research and started then dedicating about 15 hours a week of diving into both pop culture trends, tech trends, and the clinical research. In those days, 15 years ago, there wasn't much. Now I can barely keep up, but that's how the book came to be. I really preferred to do experiential speaking opportunities, so I did that for years and years, but then I couldn't get myself to as many places as were interested in the topic, so I decided to write the book.
So when you talk to people at around the country, and you do a lot of speaking, what advice do you give people about how to manage digital technology?
I say two things. First of all, amp up your embodied environment and your comfort with being uncomfortable, inconvenienced, bored, and awkward. So we just really get more in your skin, find those things that are fiery. And then the other thing is really to employ of 10 minutes a day. And if you can do 10 minutes twice a day, where you practice either a mindfulness meditation, hopefully without your phone, or you literally sit and stare into space. And if you can link that with something that you do every day. So for instance, I've had a lot of gamers tell me that it's really effective for them. The first time they pick up their game controller of the day, they realize, okay, if I have enough time to pick this up and I'm probably going to play for a couple of hours, I can do my 10 minutes. So they set it down and do their 10 minutes or linking it with brushing your teeth or whatever it is. But if we could create that habit, that has the huge potential of impacting both the literal wiring of our brain and also just our, maybe the habit that we might love being with ourselves.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a real honor and really fun. Thank you.
I have been talking today with Doreen Dogen McGee, who has recently published Deviced, Balancing Life and Technology in Today's Digital World.
I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is Radio Zine on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
This is indeed the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland, your community radio. We're creeping up on 9:30 a.m., at which time we will hear Disability Justice with Gabriel Guaidon, director of Oregon Self-Advocate Coalition. So keep it locked right here, KBOO.FM, 90.7 FM, in Portland Metro, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and 104.3 FM Philomath.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Here in the studio today is Gabrielle Guaidon, director of OSAC,
the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition.
So, Gabrielle, would you mind giving us a little history on OSAC?
The Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition is a coalition made up of 18 groups throughout Oregon that are built from self-advocates. We also support individuals that have intellectual and developmental disability to have a voice in their life. But the true meaning behind OSAC is the advocates themselves who give us strength to do the work. Originally, Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition was actually known as Self-Advocates as Leaders. That was actually created out of the institutions themselves. The people...
Institutions. What institutions are we speaking of?
Fairview and other ones. At the moment, I can't remember the names of them, but Fairview is a really well-known one. And the institutions were where people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were actually just pushed into because they were born with a disability. It was not the easiest place for people to live, and when it came to time for the advocates to stand up and to start advocating, they were able to start creating advocacy groups, which in return ended up turning Self-Advocates as Leaders into OSAC.
Gabrielle, would you tell us about some of the successes OSAC has had?
Well, the Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition actually became their own nonprofit organization, which is really exciting because it is advocate-ran. It is not just any organization. The people that are actually advocating are the ones that are running it.
By advocates, you mean people with intellectual disabilities are actually directing your efforts?
Yes, they are, 100% of the way. Without the advocates, I wouldn't have the job I have and be doing what I do. So we also, Oregon Self-Advocacy has also went and did a lawsuit called Lane versus Brown, which it is, I know Voc Rehab and some other organizations were involved, and it was based upon employment for all. So people actually being able to have the jobs they want in their community and being able to get the resources to be able to get those jobs. So that was a big win for us and also for the community itself, because now there's a lot of people that are actually benefiting from it, and they're having to like work on how they structure it so everybody's getting the equal opportunity. And I must say, the Voc Rehab, had to go back to them myself, and they have changed some stuff. So that was pretty cool to see on first-hand basis. And I do have an intellectual and developmental disability myself. So that experience was wonderful for me. OSAC has also done a peer-to-peer mentoring project, which is we had 6 advocates that turned into peer mentors go across the state and teach classes to other people about employment and to give them the information so they could choose to be able to get the job if they want in the community and what services they can use and what they can advocate for. Mm. Also, we do a lot of legislative work, and we do team up with John and Dina on a regular basis. And so there's a lot of advocacy at the legislative sessions that go on, and I really recommend people standing up and actually doing it, because you will feel empowered by having your voice heard.
I know the Go Project Days go up there and they interact with the legislators. And most of the time you guys kind of like also cooperate with the Go Project in getting people, self-advocates, up there to interact with the legislators. Are you guys planning to do that again this year?
This year is going to be actually a shorter year, so we will be doing some of that work, but the 2021 is going to be our really big year, which is going to be the long session, and there's going to be more DD days, which is Go Project Days, on top of just you can go up there anytime if you can't fit it into your schedule during the Go Project Days.
So, Gabrielle, being that we go so often up to the legislative sessions, who are the friendly legislators towards the IDD community?
Well, we actually, Oregon has a lot of them. We have so much support. It's actually been really awesome to see the support we've had, and especially during testimonies and just every day going and talking to them. But there is a couple that I think that we want to highlight at the moment, even though all of them are actually fantastic to us, where we get all excited when we go there.
Yes.
But somebody that has actually been there before I even got this job was actually Sarah Gelser.
And Alyssa Kenny-Geyer from the representative sides?
Yes. Those are two awesome women that really have had our back, as well as a lot of other ones.
Oh, yes. I mean, there are so many that have been so helpful. They've actually sat down and listened to me, even though I wasn't from their district. I mean, it's kind of cool to have representatives or legislators listen to you, even though you're not part of their district. So they're all friendly, kind of, most of them are friendly towards us.
Yeah, and something to also consider is that the legislators themselves actually want to hear your stories. They don't want to hear the, you know, just other legislators' stories. They want to hear the people that receive services who actually experience different things. Or even if it's not just disability related, everything, even if it's just a day to day, we're all human at the end of the day. So they just want to know how to best support people throughout the state.
Yeah, our legislators are really good at that. So, Gabrielle, can you tell me about the regional reps and their support, the other position underneath the regional reps?
So we're actually going to be hiring for the regional rep program, which is a program that will be placed in 4 different regions throughout the state. We're actually hiring 9 contractors to fill those positions. 1 support contractor who will actually run the program for us, and then 8 other ones, which include 4 regional reps and 4 community connectors.
And what are the community connectors? Who are they?
The community connectors will be the people that support the regional reps to do their jobs, like assistants. They're going to be doing the admin stuff and the support behind it and supporting the regional reps in any way they need to make sure that people in the IDD, Intellectual and Developmental Disability Service community, can actually have their voices heard.
And the regional reps themselves, what are their responsibilities?
They're to actually be the ones that are going out and supporting and mentoring and help create groups throughout the whole state, as well as support the groups that are local already and get people into advocacy and also support them to be able to speak up for themselves. But something to remember is the community connectors will be doing the same thing, but the regional reps are people that have to have intellectual and developmental disabilities. And the community connectors can have disabilities or don't have to be, and same for the support contractor.
And when do you suppose you'll get that in place?
We're actually working on a lot of the development. As a lot of people know, it takes a while to develop a statewide program slash project. And so we're in the middle of development of the trainings and getting somebody on board for the contractor positions, as well as making sure everyone feels supported, because that is actually OSAC's number one thing, is making sure people feel supported in their positions when they're working with us.
Gabrielle, what are the work groups about?
So there are actually a couple that come to mind right now. The ISP redesign is individual support plan, and it is to help people be able to create goals and to have their lives go and their services go the way they need and want them to go. That one's actually being worked on, and it is having a lot of stakeholders involved with it to be able to make sure everyone's being heard. Advocates are actually on that work group, and we are looking forward to when it comes out, and it'll actually help people be able to use their services the way they want to.
Will it also be able to help them to increase their hours if they need to be increased?
So with the individual support plan, it is not per se, that's not the way to get hours. You would go on to the Oregon Needs Assessment, which is actually going to be coming out kind of fixed. They have work groups that are actually working on that as well, which will actually help be able to figure out how many hours you can get with the Oregon Needs Assessment. But remember, if you have had your hours cut due to ONA, you can go and tell your personal agent or service coordinator that you would like to have it reevaluated, and there might be some stuff that's actually missing out of it. You can always go back and say, I would like to talk about redoing this.
Yeah, I've been through that process. It is quite lengthy and takes quite a bit of time. And you really got to put in some effort to get what you want.
Yes, definitely. But at the same time, the Oregon Needs Assessment is being worked on right now, and I'm actually involved with that. And we are actually putting our two cents in on making sure that it's heard, certain things are heard, please watch out for this, this is how I use my services, you know, and just kind of working with the state, who's actually been really encouraging and really been like, we want an advocate or two on those work groups. So they've really been encouraging about making sure people from families to siblings to the individuals that receive their services, and of course professionals, are on those groups.
And just out of curiosity, you know, there might be a few people that feel like they're not very well represented. Is there some way for them to get on to these committees at this time, or are they completely inaccessible at this time?
At the moment, because the projects, the multiple groups or meetings are actually so far into it, it is going to be hard to do that, but you can contact Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition. Tell us your story, and we will take it to them. We will make sure that what you tell us is actually being heard, and we'll make it so you don't have to not feel like you're not being heard.
I know there are many people, including myself, that always feel like somehow we are left out of the process. Even though we are strong self-advocates, it still feels like we're just not heard.
Yeah, I know it can be really frustrating. I actually used to experience that a lot before having this job. And I'm always there to listen and to be able to just be able to support people. But also, if you tell me your story and you tell me what's going on, I can bring it to some people that are around me. I do multiple groups in Salem during the month, and so I can as long as you tell me your stories, I can actually bring it to light.
But you're not, you can't actually make a, you can't actually wave a magic wand and make things go away, can you?
No, but you can actually have your voice heard. And also, you'd be really surprised about the Say workers. They actually want to hear those out of everything. Also, OSAC does do a open house once a year, and Lilia Tennedy, the director, actually comes to that event herself.
Hmm. We should have her come in one of these days.
She would actually, she's really, really gets excited working with advocates. She actually emphasizes on working with advocates instead of just with the professionals or the family members.
All right. Thank you. So, Gabrielle, can we talk about your committees? And I do believe there's four of them, the Legislative Committee, Housing Committee, Healthcare Committee, and Employment Committee. Did I get all of them right?
Yes. Those, each of those committees have different goals. They're just like they sound. Legislative is doing project with legislative session, the GO project, kind of the different bills that are coming out, and also just making sure we're being heard and known in the community.
Do they also do senatorial hearings as well?
Yes, we definitely do a lot of testimony. Also on that committee, we actually have created letters with support of a somebody that does legislative work to go to the legislators on the different topics that they're requesting it on. It's like doing testimony, but with a group and making sure everyone's voice is heard.
And you're looking for people to join this committee that are outside of OSAC, but inside the IDD community.
Yes. So when you join the group, you do sign up as a member to be on that. But the commitment is usually only an hour, hour and a half. But during projects or special occasions, they can be more.
And that's generally across the phone, isn't it? So, I mean, phone or Zoom, something like that, so you don't actually have to travel.
No, it's always over the phone. And if you have any accommodations you need, please let us know, and we will do our best to actually accommodate to whatever is needed. The Employment Committee is, we talk to people about employment. We also supported a bill called a lawsuit called Lane versus Brown, which created rules and regulations to make sure that different service providers for employment are actually supporting with people with IDD to have jobs that they want in their community and have the knowledge they need to be able to have those jobs. Then we also have the Healthcare Committee. The Healthcare Committee has actually created modules on different things of ways to talk to your doctors, what to expect, little checklists, a little bit of everything on top of videos, which the healthcare committee actually got to act out in those videos. And they're actually an OHSU's and OSAC's actually involved with it. And it gives OSAC some prompts on that as well. There is always those type of situations. Also in the employment committee, I did forget to bring up one thing. There's an employment provider guide out there that actually the employment committee actually helped recreate for the state, because it just was not making sense to people. It was not the way that we needed it to be able to use it effectively and be able to choose what employment provider we wanted and what services to use. And then the housing committee is actually our newest committee. They have a survey that I really recommend everybody contacting us about and filling it out. We have a really fabulous person that's actually the chair on that committee, who actually has real housing background and has connections. And all these committees are always looking for new projects to make sure everyone's heard.
And the person on the housing committee, that's Alan Hines?
Yes.
The director of Real Choice Initiative?
Yes.
And they're already pretty, Real Choice Initiative is already pretty well involved in housing issues.
Yes, definitely. He's actually the chair on that committee, and he is wanting to start off with a survey, but he's also wanting to do more projects to support people's voices. And he really emphasizes on having people's voices heard.
All right. And each one of these committees, they're like an hour and a half on the phone or on Zoom.
Yes.
And you are looking for people that are part of the IDD community. They don't necessarily have to be a part of OSAC.
Well, with the committees, you do have to technically sign up as a member, but that does not mean you have to be involved with anything else that OSAC does. It is really, if you don't want to go do legislative stuff, you don't have to do legislative stuff. You want to sign up for only one of these committees, you don't have to do any more than that. Uh-huh. It's really based upon what you want. We do want consistent people, though, because we need your voices. Your voices are the reason OSAC is who they are, and that's how we are able to advocate, is by having everyone's voice heard, not just a few throughout the state, because we are a statewide coalition.
And what is the capacity of these committees? I mean, are you guys pretty packed with staff members that can take on lots of projects, or is it mostly the people on the committees will be taking on the projects themselves when it comes to, like, if you're on housing, then you'll probably have to get a little bit more involved with housing, or is it you can be as little or as much involved as you can tolerate?
Well, with that, we do have, of course, our committee members are number one, and we support people to do things. We are working on the regional rep program right now, so we're really focusing on that, but are looking for projects to get going and to kind of plan out for the future for those committees, and also do small things right now to get things going. What we really look for is actually people that are willing to commit on doing, being part of that committee and having their voice heard, and being able to also have people say, hey, I have this idea. Let's talk about it. Let's see what we can do to make this come to reality.
And I was wondering about, I know that this year we did get some rental control, and I was just kind of curious. I think Alan was kind of really poignant in getting some stuff across. So, I mean, that's definitely one committee that's definitely had some success, hasn't it?
Well, all the committees actually this past year have been working towards getting more goals and doing stuff. But we're constantly looking for new projects and also looking for more grants to do those projects as well. So that is a really big one. And so he emphasized on the housing committee and listening to people's voices and making sure they're all heard. The employment provider guide came out this past year. And also the healthcare toolkit just came out as well this past year. And the videos were professionally done with support with OHSU, and the committee members are done that. Legislative committee, this past year we did some legislative work and also did a written out testimony, which is with the legislative committee all got to go together and actually say their part to make sure it was heard in the testimony.
And OHU?
OHSU.
Yeah, what is exactly?
Oregon Health and Science University. We do a lot of work with them. And you said, I must apologize, I don't remember the full write out of that name, but they have been really big with us too. They support our healthcare committee and also help us do projects, which are the people that are actually were involved with that type of stuff.
Oh, so you do have a partner with one of your committees.
We do have partners. We do partners, but the main voice on those committees needs to be the people that receive services, or even if you don't, have to have intellectual and developmental disabilities. And of course, all community partners are always welcome.
All right. Gabrielle, thank you for being here. And I do hope to have you back after you've gotten your regional rep project going. We really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The four committees of OSAC are legislative, housing, healthcare, and employment. If you're interested, please contact Gabrielle Gourdon.
gabrielle.gudon@askosac.org. www.disabilitygenesis.org. Her number is 503-308-1310. You can also go to askosac.org. That's askosac.org.
Go Project Day is February 12th, Wednesday, in room 350 at the Oregon Salem Capitol Building.
If you want more information about the Oregon DD Coalition Go Project, go to ORDDCoalition, that's COALITION.org.
Our self-advocate taking action meeting is every second Friday of the month from 11 to 1 p.m. at the Seven Corners Building.
The Seven Corners Building is located at 2475 Southeast Ladd Avenue in Southeast Portland. Also at the Seven Corners Building is Real Choice Initiative's Coffee Hour from 2 to 4 every fourth Saturday of the month. So this month of February, it will be on the 22nd.
During Real Choice Initiative coffee hours, we discuss the various problems that are existing within the disabilities community. We invite you to come and join us. Something fun to do every week.
Another fun thing is that Oregon City Library has really been listening to the intellectually disabled community and listening to what we want as far as programming. So they have developed something called Because Accessibility Matters, and has a lot of programs coming up for us.
If you have a disability story that you would like to share, go to ucporegon.org, scroll down the list, and find This Is Our Voice. Trump's continuing war on those with disabilities and the poor. Keep your eyes on his planned cuts to SSD and food stamps. Trust me, people, he's going after Social Security next.
Next week will be KBOO's fundraiser, and it is programs like ours that you will be helping to give a voice to people who are not normally heard. So please take that time to give next week.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Indeed, that was Disability Justice on KBOO Portland. We're creeping up on 9:58 a.m. At 10, we'll hear Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. And we're gonna keep on chilling with my homies musically for the next couple minutes. Run out the hour. You know, you don't have to wait for the fun drive, the membership drive next week. You could go to kboo.fm/give. Or you could use the mobile app and click where it says donate. I guess you tap when you're on a mobile device. Mm-hmm. They'll take you through a safe, secure, and easy and convenient form. You can have a credit card or debit charged once or monthly. You can ask for help with instructing your financial institution to give KBOO a set amount every month on your behalf. You'll hear. You know, check it out. If you prefer to wait, you know, it's always a party. We'd love to have you over then. There's lots of great radio happening today, and it's all because your friends and neighbors got involved in the way and to the extent that makes sense to them. So, take a moment, think about, what is the amount of your radio bill? Go to kboo.fm and pay it.
Hello, I'm Bob Madar. Join me for episode 5 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast and meet Rick, the manager of Project Action at the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center. Rick was formerly homeless and now devotes his time to helping local folks who are homeless change their lives and find employment and housing. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Special K on Friday, February 14th from 7:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Imago Theater in Portland. Special K draws on popular culture to explore the inner and outer dimensions of theatrical convention, mental health, and the nature of reality. Again, that's Special K on Friday, February 14th from 7:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Imago Theater, located at 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio